This week in Retronauts, we're not talking about the worst X-Men villain. Welcome to a Retronauts East. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this week we're talking about the classic days of the American arcade, which is something we've kind of covered before, but this is going to be different. It's going to be a loose, freeform approach. For example, I don't know if this is going to be a full episode or a micro episode. We're just kind of winging it, but I do know that we're not going to talk about Arcade from the X-Men, because that guy sucked and all of his stories were stupid, and he was in a bad video game. So instead of talking about that, let's talk about the good stuff about arcades, like going to coin-op machines and putting quarters in and hanging out at pizza joints and watching weird, scary robot animals sing. And here to talk with me about these things this week, we have
Benj Edwards.
And also
Ben Elgin,
who is fresh from Eclipse Land, and I can see the crescent-shaped scars burned onto your eyes.
Totally, totally.
You did a Trump, didn't you? You looked directly at the sun.
I mostly managed to use the glasses.
Oh, okay. Well, that was good thinking. You're clearly unfit to be president.
Yeah, yeah.
So this episode is the first that we're recording in something that I hope will be kind of a loose, tentative series of sorts of episodes really based around recollections and not so much about hard facts and info and research and that sort of thing, but more about our personal experiences playing video games and the kind of the processes that we went through, the things that have vanished now, like the things that we did in the past and you can't really do now because those cultures and those technologies are gone. And this was kind of Benj's idea.
Yeah.
So
I do a lot of writing.
Take credit for it.
Well, thank you. I do a lot of writing about the culture of technology and video games because I'm interested in preserving not just physical artifacts, but also the stories of how people use the technology. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I think, you know, someone who is maybe 20 years old listening to this podcast wouldn't necessarily know what it was like to go to an arcade back when people actually went to arcades and the games there were fresh and amazing. And, you know, to know what it was like to see Dragon's Lair and be like, wow, there's a cartoon on my computer screen. What's happening? Yeah, they're just, you know, life is different. The experience that my elementary age nephews and cousins have playing video games is very, very different than the ones that I had. I mean, they still love video games just the way that I did, but the ones they love and the relationship they have with those games is very different than, you know, I didn't have YouTube when I was in elementary school, so I did not want action figures of my favorite YouTubers. Whereas my nephew does. He thinks it's really cool to have a toy version of Crobcat or whoever his name is, and that's great. Congratulations to Crobcat or whatever his name is for helping to, you know, create that kind of culture. And I'm happy for my nephew that he has like aspirational heroes playing video games that, you know, he can look up to. That's kind of cool. That's something I didn't have as a kid. The best I had was Kevin Flynn. I don't know.
Billy Mitchell?
He wasn't really around doing that thing until like the late 90s.
Yeah,
that's true. I never heard of him till early 2000s.
I mean, we had the people in the magazines were like the only kind of personalities that we'd be conscious of, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there were the kids who like won the Nintendo Power contests, and I would be like, damn you, I wanted that to be me. But they never liked my submissions.
Yeah.
I never went on to become the author of Danger Girl. That's my loss. And the world's.
Weren't there some game shows where kids played video games and competed?
There were, but none of those
terrible.
Really. Yeah. Like those didn't have any appeal to me. It was more the stuff that I could directly relate to, like here is a contest to come up with a video game story or a video game concept. I was like, oh, that's cool. I want to win one of these. But I never did.
Get your design in Mega Man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, did they ever? They did one of those in the U.S. I think, wasn't there?
I'm
like,
not sure if U.S. ones made it. And
man, I want to say one of the Mega Man 6 robots came from the U.S.
Like Galaxy.
I think you're right.
Galaxy Man was later.
So that was 8.
Yeah, 9.
9. Okay, I'm mixing 20. Them up with someone else.
That's okay. if only there were a Mega Man 20, but no.
Although you could get your envelope art printed in Nintendo Power if you were lucky. That was almost
doable. I didn't even get that.
I don't know if I ever actually had one.
I don't know that I ever sent an envelope of art to Nintendo Power, but I did send one to GamePro.
Yeah.
Very, very beginning, I drew a really cool picture of Bloody Moth from Ninja Gaiden. And nice. They did not print it.
Oh, man.
Alas.
Although speaking of GamePro, I feel like kind of like some of the GamePro like wacky columnist personalities might have been the closest thing we had to these YouTube guys.
There were
like,
actually action figures of GamePro.
Were there? I didn't
Personae.
See
that. I think that was the early 2000s.
Yeah,
I don't think it was
later,
in the 90s. Yeah, it was a little little after
Scary Larry.
I believe Scary Larry did have an action figure.
Wow.
Don't quote me on that, but I know that there were GamePro action figures, and I think there were some IGN action figures.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like Sushi X too early for that.
No, this was, I think, later. Yeah,
too late for that.
Yeah.
Also, Sushi X was EGM.
That was EGM. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Mix on my comments.
So who was Sushi X?
It's a secret. Sushi X was,
like,
well,
10 different people writing under.
Yeah, I can't remember the original guy who did it, but after he left, I think his name was Ken something. After he left, Sushi X just became like a thing that was sort of like assigned to people. I don't know. Sushi X was before my time with EGM, and I was never actually on EGM staff. I just contributed. So I don't know all the full scuttlebutt. Someone like, I don't know, Dan Hsu could tell you, but I could not. Mark McDonald, Chris Johnson, you know. These guys are out there. I'm sure they've talked about it on their respective podcasts.
Yeah, I think I read about the identity of Sushi X, but I just forgot.
Yeah, I mean, after a while, it was pretty much just like, okay, you're the guy who's going to write Sushi X this month.
Yeah, it became a column rather than a person. Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the same thing with Quarterman also.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
It
yeah.
was a guy at first, and then, you know.
Kevin
after,
Quarterman.
What's that?
Kevin Quarterman.
Was it? Was that his name? But it was with two N's.
Yeah, Quarterman.
Which not, man, should not be mistaken Skowitz. For the Half-Man, Tyrion Lannister. Totally different. Before we dive into the show, gentle fans, I have a quick request for help. We're looking for listener feedback from the Retronauts audience. This podcast is partially funded by ads, as you've surely noticed by now, and this is your chance to help fine-tune the ads you hear. By knowing more about you, the Podcast One sales team can help us run ads for things you might actually care about, which will make your listening experience better and help keep the lights on at Retronauts HQ. If you don't mind, we're asking you to take a quick and completely anonymous survey. When you have a moment, we'd be grateful if you could point your browser to podcastone.com/mysurvey and take the quick poll you'll find there. Or you can just go to podcastone.com and click the survey banner. Or we'll even post a link at retronauts.com for you. 5 minutes of your time is all we're asking for to make our show better for us and for you. Thanks so much.
Cars, what are they? Frankly, I don't know. So it goes without saying that if I had to buy one of these quote-unquote cars, if they even exist, I'd need a lot of help. Why, for all I know, your average car must cost upwards of $3 million. Thankfully, services like TrueCar exist to inform people like me about all things car-like. So if you're in the market for a new ride, consider turning to TrueCar. With TrueCar, you can see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want. Information that empowers you to feel confident. Once you register with TrueCar, you can connect with a certified local dealer and see real pricing on actual inventory. And with over 13,000 certified TrueCar dealers nationwide and over 3 million cars sold by TrueCar dealers, you can rest assured that TrueCar has a history of happy customers. Customers who, on average, save $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
Well, if you want to talk about arcades first, I have a question yes. for you.
Okay, okay.
Which is that see, I was born in 81, so I visited arcades. Yeah, I visited arcades in the 80s from when I was really little, you know, and mostly in the late 80s, though. But the golden age of the American arcade was around 82, I'd say, or 81. And you were probably old enough to go during that time. Can you describe what it was like?
I was just starting to be able to go to arcades at that point. That was about when you started seeing the proliferation of things like Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah.
We didn't have Chuck E. Cheese, but we had Showbiz Pizza.
We had
Pizza.
Showbiz, yeah, same.
And then there was a place called Pistol Pete's that was like a local Texas and New Mexico thing. Hmm. And my memories of Showbiz and Pistol Pete's are, I did some reading on this recently, and it turns out that the reason my memories are separate is because Showbiz Pizza went out of business in Lubbock, Texas, and they sold all of their machines and their animatronics to Pistol Pete's, which is why Pistol Pete's had all the same stuff that Showbiz did. And they were just down the street from each other.
It jumbled your memory forever.
It kind of did. There was like this brief period of overlap. So I want to say like 1983, 84, it gets kind of nebulous for me, but yeah, for a while there were a couple of those restaurants, those pizza places that had the big amusement areas. And what was your original question?
I was just the golden age of arcades. What was it like to step into an arcade then? Did you go to one that wasn't Chuck E. Cheese?
Yeah. Well, they were all not Chuck E. Cheese. Because as I mentioned, we didn't have Chuck E. Cheese.
Okay, well, yeah, there wasn't Chuck.
Yes, there were arcades that were not just, you know, adjunct to pizza places with bad pizza, and those were mostly in the mall when I was very young. There were a couple of places there was one called Tilt, and I can't remember the other one. But
I think we had a Tilt.
Yeah, but they were very sort of dark, cavernous spaces that went sort of, you know, they were like a narrow storefront, and they went a long way back into the store. So yeah, it was very dungeon like. And this was when you could smoke inside malls. So you would go into those arcades, and I remember them being very smoky. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly like, you know, quote unquote big kids. It was like teenagers mm-hmm. who, when I was 6-7 years old, were like, wow, scary. Yeah. It's so intimidating. Yeah, so I didn't really go to those a lot until I was older, and they had started to get a little brighter. They banned smoking, but there was definitely a sense of like, this is not a friendly place for kids in the mall arcades. And that's, I think, mm-hmm. why most of my memories are, you know, adjunct to the pizza places.
Yeah, so the biggest one I remember, I think it might have been a Tilt at one of the local malls, was actually, I think, under the food court. So it was actually kind of a basement.
Whoa.
So there was a big food court, and then there was a big like double stairs down, and there was one of those Tilt arcades. And yeah, very dark and neon lit. This is St. Louis.
Okay.
And so we also had Showbiz Pizza, not Chuck E. Cheese. So I went there for parties and stuff. But yeah, there was definitely a Tilt or two or things like that in some of the malls. And yeah, like Jeremy said, it was definitely, we're a little young for that in the early 80s, because, you know, we were grade school. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a little bit intimidating.
Yeah, I'll say a point about the smoking, because I remember going to an arcade where there was an ashtray on every single machine. Mm. And a lot of them had, you know, burn marks, scorch marks from cigarettes, you know, on the plastic bezels on the control panel.
Yeah, I remember those days too. It was a few months ago when I was in Japan.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you could still smoke in Tokyo arcades.
Wow.
So yeah, there are a lot of, I mean, they a lot of them have like smoking and non-smoking spaces now, but you can definitely go to arcades and just sit there and take a drag on a cigarette while you're going for your high score in Darius Twin or whatever.
Yeah, I had that experience in Japan in the late 90s also.
So that whole scene where the arcades were unfriendly to kids is one of the main reasons why Chuck E. Cheese was founded.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, video games kind of got their start in bars. I mean, if you look back, you know,
think about
Space War and Pong and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Tabletop cabinets.
Yeah, I mean, they spun out of pinball and some other similar amusements, which were meant for, you know, like adult spaces. So it took a while for them to sort of shed that sort of seedy vibe to them and become friendlier to kids. And things like Pac-Man definitely helped because they were bright and colorful and they appealed to kids and they appealed to women, not just like drunk middle-aged dudes. So
I did an article about Chuck E. Cheese a few months ago for Fast Company about the 40th anniversary. And I was doing research on arcades in the early 70s to see what the press thought about them. And it was always like roving bands of evil teenagers go there and smoke weed and do interracial dancing. And, you know everything that was
awesome.
That sounds good.
Everything that was a concern in middle America in the 1970s. So, you know, Nolan Bushnell had the idea to change the venue for his games and his company's games. And that's how Chuck E. Cheese was born.
Yep. And, I mean, it was a success.
And I have tokens here from my Chuck E. Cheese when I was a kid. You want to see them?
Just think, each one of those is a lost opportunity to play a video game. You missed out.
What's the inflation rate? If one is 25 cents, 1980.
So they're probably worth like 80 to 90 cents.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like getting towards a dollar.
So I could put it in a modern machine and get a dollar play.
Well, you could play one play in Japan because they're 100 yen
per
play.
Dollar.
I've got some more, but I was interested because I went to a Chuck E. Cheese when I was really little. There's one near my house in Raleigh, and I didn't know what year it opened. I was researching it for my article, but I've got a token here that says 1980, so it was pretty early. It was even before
that's
I was
just
born.
When they were minted. So that doesn't necessarily
mean
they
were
when
in circulation.
The one here opened up. But yeah.
Well, no, it says Raleigh NC on it.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it's got a thing.
Dang. Hey,
look at the bottom. And it says, "In pizza we trust."
Yep.
Not that pizza.
No, that was
terrible. I've eaten Chuck E. Cheese pizza.
It's all right.
Definitely went for the video games and the creepy singing bear.
Creepy robots.
I mean, you went because you got him.
I guess he was a singing mouse. The bear was
Yeah, the bear was
showbiz.
I've got a showbiz token, too.
So the Rockafire explosion, that was showbiz,
that was showbiz, yes. I had that, definitely. But yeah, in my experience, you mostly went to showbiz because you got invited to some kid's party.
Yeah,
because it was a cheap place to entertain a lot of kids for a few hours.
Listen to all these tokens. I'm rich.
Just think of how many games you did not play as a kid. You missed out.
Yeah, I got.
Think what a better video game journalist you could be if you'd spent those the way you were supposed to.
But I'm better because I saved
them. 45. Is it Donald Trump's showbiz token?
This is 45 on it.
It's one of them, Zid. It had 45 written on it.
Maybe it's 45 cents.
That's a play in
25.
A play in 4/5.
This one's an ancient Roman token.
Yeah,
corroded.
You could probably use that as a subway token in New York.
Aladdin's castle.
Yeah, we had an Aladdin's.
We had that at Crabtree
in my college town. So Crabtree Mall used to be like kind of low rent then, as opposed to the upscale buy a sports car kind of place it is now.
It was. That the Crabtree was the upscale mall in Raleigh.
Oh, okay.
North Hills was all right. It was just one sort of simple indoor mall, and then we went there.
I guess
all
this
the
is kind of getting to be inside pool, but yeah, but I do miss. I do feel kind of sad that I missed out on the days when this city had arcades.
Yeah, well, there's one on Hillsborough Street called Starcade that was legendary because they had some of the early '80s games like Tempest and stuff.
Nice.
Or what year was Tempest anyway?
That was 1981.
Yeah, they had those, you know, up until the 90s, when a lot of other places churned through their games and would switch them out with newer ones and stuff. And there was an arcade. There were some at these strip malls in various places that would pop up and go. But there was one at Crabtree in the food court. I think it was this Aladdin's Castle. So that was neat.
Be able to see arcade games pretty much anywhere you went. Like I remember I've talked about on the show before, my first memory of playing an arcade game was in the middle of the Sears lawn department where there was a brand new Ms. Pac-Man machine just sitting there by itself amidst the lawnmowers. And I was like, can I play this, Mom? And so they gave me a quarter and I died before finishing the first stage. But I was excited because I made one of the fruits appear before I died. Nice. I thought that meant I won or something. and like you would go to convenience stores, and there would be like an Akari Warriors that the crank mechanism on the joystick didn't work anymore. Yeah. Or you'd go to like a drugstore, and out in that sort of mudroom area that you go to, like, you know, in between the store
the lobby
and
the kind of.
Yeah, it's not a lobby. I don't know, like
breezeway.
An anteroom. Sure, an breezeway sounds good.
I feel like the last bastion.
Like there would be a couple of those. Those eventually were replaced with like electromechanical, you know, rides for the kids.
Yeah, like the last bastion of that setup now, I think, is like, you'll see that in the theaters still, where like out in the lobby there's a section.
Yeah.
This little room with like three sad arcade games and like Deer Hunter and maybe a couple mechanical things.
Yep.
Yeah, we used to. There was usually an arcade game at the movie theater near my house, and we'd play like Marble Madness there. I remember it was a two theater, really tiny theater. Two screen theater.
That jogs my memory. I have played Marble Madness stand up before, back in the day. Yeah.
What about Pizza Hut? Did you guys ever play?
Pizza Hut did have a couple of video games. We never went to Pizza Hut. We always went to a local like Texas chain called Pinocchio's Pizza.
And
I've talked about that
because
that was
pizza in Texas.
It was big. They had this big, thick pan crust pizza, like Chicago style. It was really good.
Pizza Hut was that thick.
Yeah, whatever.
Look at that.
Yeah, I think I played Pac-Man and Pizza Hut in St. Louis.
Pizza. Yeah. Yeah. Well, at my local Pizza Hut, there was always a cocktail machine in the little, there's a little room with a payphone and a cocktail machine going to the bathrooms. And, while we'd go as a family and my parents would sit at the table and order a pitcher of beer or something and just start drinking it. And then me and my brother would go to the arcade game and play Ms. Pac-Man or Donkey Kong. And there were always cocktail machines, the kind that looked like a table, for those of you who don't know what that means.
You should know, though.
Yeah, so you can get a two-player setup where the screen's in the middle and you have two sets of controls on the table, yeah.
Yeah, each player's on each side. I always wanted one of those. I still don't have one.
In hindsight, I really feel for adults who took us to those Pizza Place arcades because, like, the pizza at Showbiz and Chuck E. Cheese was not good pizza.
No.
And they had to sit on these, like, uncomfortable benches in this room with singing robots and bad lighting and... Like,
oh, I know, like my parents avoided it at all costs.
They really, like, my parents loved me. They would suffer through that sometimes. And I think mostly we went after report cards came in because I think that was one of those places that was like, if you get all A's, then you get, you know, $2 off your pizza or something. So we would make the rounds to all the places that had report card rewards. And that was definitely one of them.
Yeah, showing it off then.
We had free Pizza Hut rewards from the Scholastic Book Program.
Yeah, Book It.
Book It, yes.
Remember Book It?
Yeah. Book It did Pizza Hut rewards, so that would be a lot of the times we were at Pizza Hut.
I never hear about stuff like that anymore. I don't know if places still do that. Is that like back when the economy was good?
Reading isn't cool anymore, really.
It's fundamental, though.
It's fundamental.
Totally. Well, but yeah, like... One of my biggest memories of Showbiz is unfortunately not the arcade games because I would go there to other people's parties and I would end up trying to figure out how to game the tickets as best I could. And like the best way I usually found was to get good at skee-ball. So I ended up spending a lot of time on the skee-ball at Showbiz
to try to
convert my coins into tickets and get the cool, completely useless crap from behind the counter.
Yeah, we should talk about Redemption Arcades a little bit because I was trying to research.
Even the games
that's one of the things that still exists.
Yeah, they are the only profitable arcades these days, supposedly. The business model that survived was the Redemption Arcade because people pour, you know, $20 into finding, you know, trying to get a 75-cent plastic, cheap thing from China or something. But I think that I'm probably wrong, but Chuck E. Cheese was the place that at least popularized the redemption model. And I don't know if it was the very first. It's usually hard to say that.
Certainly the biggest one.
I feel like the redemption model existed on, you know, in like electromechanical arcades. Yeah, skee-ball has been around longer than
other
video
places
games.
Had skee-ball, but.
So, like, I look
You're
back.
Right, yeah.
I don't know.
It's probably a carnival thing. Actually,
you definitely have those at carnivals.
But like, I think back to, you know, like boardwalk arcades where there aren't any video games. It's just all electromechanical machines. Like, there's still some of those around, like Santa Cruz, California. You see those, and there are just lines of skee ball tables. I didn't think to look up any info on that because I didn't know we were going in that direction.
But. Yeah, well, I brought along tickets. Speaking of Redemption Arcade, I've got all my tickets here. I found some from Chuck E. Cheese.
What kind of junk you could have gotten with those, man?
Look at this. This says Fanny Farkle, Indiana
Fanny Farkle.
Ticket.
That
one's from Gatlinburg.
Yeah,
I've mentioned my Gatlinburg arcade exploits on Retronauts before. These are the original Chuck E. Cheese tickets. Yep. See, they're gray. I did these as a retro scan of the week a few months ago on my blog.
It's gray, just like the pizza.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think I came across any Showbiz ones when I was cleaning out my closets. I must have spent them all.
This is from when Showbiz and Pizza Time were combined.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize they teamed up one big pile of mediocrity.
Chuck E. Cheese went bankrupt in 1984 or something like that. You read my article, you'll find the details. But Showbiz came in and bought it. And so for a while, they would maintain separate locations. Eventually, they merged into one, and Chuck E. Cheese brand took over. So. Mm.
Even though Showbiz was the profitable one.
Yeah. That's well, it's complicated. You got to read that article. You know, Nolan Bushnell tried to turn Pizza Time Theater, which is the Chuck E. Cheese company name, into a diversified leisure company for a while. And he was turning it into something that would make its own arcade games and invest in animation technology and all kinds of different things that he wanted to do. Hmm. And it just put too many eggs in one very weak basket that was based on a gimmick with those robots, you know, that got oversaturated and copied a million times. And when the economy turned sour and there was a tech crash in 83, you know, just the bottom pulled out and he couldn't get any more credit to run those things, you know, all of his ventures that he was doing. So
I see. But you know, even though they were a financial failure, those robots live on with Five Nights at Freddy's, which is based very much on the experience of being very young and going and seeing those robots and being terrified.
They were pretty terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. They were originally intended to be entertainment for the adults. So in the beginning, Chuck E. Cheese was like a rat with a derby hat and a New Jersey accent and smoked a cigar. And he was like a wisecracking guy who would insult his bandmates and stuff. That was the character. And then it just got more and more watered down over time until it became a birthday party place. You know?
Yeah, saying that they were meant to appeal to the adults does make a lot of sense, because there was, I vaguely remember, some sort of risque humor, and they were singing mm-hmm. songs that kids wouldn't necessarily know, like Secret Agent Man and stuff. Like, it was like, you know, a little skewed a little older than the kids.
There was a hippo named Dolly Dimples that was by herself, and you could put a token in it, and she'd sing songs and sort of flirt with you. So that was...
Okay, then.
But this is the greatest thing about the 70s is... They were just brown and dark.
Everything was so dim. That's my memory.
Smoke.
Yeah.
It was everywhere. I mean, I wasn't alive then. I just remember okay. culture left over from, in the early 80s, things were just getting out of that. Instead of like ultra modern gray and minimalist stuff, but we still had carpets that were
shag carpets. You had the leftover avocado and goldenrod.
Yeah, and the wood grain paneled walls.
Everything was really dark and dim, sort of like in the early 80s. There was this whole, I don't know what it carried forward from, but yeah, like when I think back, I think like lots of sort of earth tones and lots of very low lighting. And that was actually advantageous for the arcades, because you don't want bright lights in the arcades. But on the other hand, like brighter spaces are more inviting. And I remember when our local putt-putt golf really did sort of an overhaul and installed a big arcade, and it was very like open and bright and clean and, you know, mm-hmm. very just an inviting space. And it didn't really badly affect the video games. I still wanted to play those video games. That was probably like 85 or so. Cause I remember it was right around the time that I was hearing ads on the radio for the Transformers movies. So whenever that happened, like I remember going to a birthday party for a friend at Putt-Putt, playing a bunch of video games and then hearing a commercial on the radio for the Transformers movie. So that's kind of how I'm cementing that in time in my mind.
I think the biggest small arcade I remember was kind of in that transition period, because it was still very dim, but they had like lots of neons up and stuff. It was trying to like look very futuristic. And so it was transitioning away from like the dark smoky bar aesthetic into something that was trying to be a little future hip and a little more light. But
I don't know that Putt-Putt was trying to be future hip, but the overall design of it was just more like, kind of like a very clean gas station with, you know, like big glass walls and metal posts and railings and that sort of thing. And then the actual arcade space was very open instead of being sort of like...
Yeah, narrow corridor.
Yeah, like the early mall arcades tended to be, you know, because they were such narrow spaces, it was basically like arcade machines lining each wall and then a row of arcade machines back-to-back in the middle, just like descending into darkness.
40 feet back and 12 feet wide or something like that.
Pretty much. Yeah. Whereas, you know, the putt-putt was... it was like clusters of machines scattered around. So there was a lot of walkability and you could kind of more like what you see in sort of retro style arcades these days. Yeah. Like if you go to a barcade, there's, you know, like Ground Control and Quarter World, I think in Portland, Oregon that we have Retronauts events at. And they're very much in that sort of style, although they are, you know, arcades. So they're a little darker inside, but there's still that sense of like openness. It's not all claustrophobic.
I kind of miss the Tron aesthetic that we got for a while though. Sort of like, you know, neon stripes everywhere.
Texas just wasn't up for that.
Oh, I just had an idea. Maybe arcades were dark because there was less glare on the monitors or something.
No, I think that that definitely played a factor there. But in general, everything was just less brightly lit back then. Like you would go to the mall and like the central corridors would be, you know, sort of airy and open. But then the actual stores tended to be a little gloomier inside.
Yeah, well, I just thinking about the Chuck E. Cheese in the early 80s when I was really little. I mean, I have some memories, probably like 2 years old, going into Chuck E. Cheese, and it was dark, really dark. And then this giant mouse and a guy in a mouse suit came up and terrified me.
And then you created Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah.
No?
I didn't. Oh. That was Scott Cawthon, I think. So off to the left, there was a like a dining area with these robots that were like torso up singing stuff, and then off to the right there was a maze that kids could crawl into, a cheese maze, and get lost in the dark.
We didn't have a maze.
Scary.
You're describing this in such a terrifying way.
Yeah, so straight ahead where
there are singing animal torsos and also a maze where you may never be seen again.
Yeah, it was scary for a two-year-old.
All of that was horrible, but the arcade part, at least at Showbiz, was really good.
Yeah.
There were so many games, and a lot of the sort of the classic game experiences I remember came from those arcades. Like, you know, you'd see the common stuff like Popeye or Dig Dug, but they also had, you know, kooky, weird, obscure stuff. Like I saw Konami's Locomotion.
Oh, wow.
The sort of, what is it, Katanga Tang clone?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It became Blodia on Game Boy.
Yeah, we did a Retronauts on the Sega.
Yeah.
Mentioned that game.
Yeah. Well, that was...
Yeah, that's right. We did mention that briefly. Then there was also actually, it was Locomotion, the Konami, the Sega game that had the Yellow Magic Orchestra music. I've forgotten. There was another one by Konami that just did the move the thing around the tracks. But anyway, like, that's where I saw that game. And so I remember seeing it. And, you know, stuff like Time Pilot, just a really random motley assortment.
That's interesting because I remember the first time I saw a lot of arcade games and where they were. You mentioned Dragon's Lair earlier, and I first saw that in an arcade in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, which was is a sort of a tourist trap town in the Great Smoky Mountains, you know, kind of close to the border of North Carolina, not exactly, but... and people were gathered around this machine, like everybody was waiting in line, and I had to, you know, sort of push my way through to see what it was. And there was a, you know, a machine with a real cartoon on it, and a guy was playing it. It had this giant glowing button and a thing, and it cost $1 to play. I was like, how could this possibly work? It's like witchcraft.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw that, which was at a university, Texas Tech University, because my father was going after his doctorate. And so sometimes, you know, he would go up to do some research or something and bring me or my brother and sister along. And as sort of a reward for our patience while he, you know, did his computer work on the big shared mainframe.
Wow.
yeah, that's a long time ago. He would take us over to the university arcade and let us spend, you know, a few minutes there to play a couple of video games. And I remember seeing...
Babysitter.
He didn't just leave us there. That would have been irresponsible. It was more like when he was done researching, then he would take us over there and spend a few minutes.
Reward for being
and
patient.
I remember seeing Dragon's Lair with just all these, you know, again, big kids gathered around it and seeing that and being like, wow, I can't wait to play that. But then eventually they got it at the Pistol Pete's Pizza, and I had the chance to play it. And I was like, this is $1, and it doesn't actually look like it's that fun.
Yeah.
It's really cool, but it doesn't seem good. So I never actually played Dragon's Lair in the arcade.
I did. It was a big ripoff.
Yeah. Because
it was impossible. If you, like, miss the first single flashing light, you die and you lose your dollar.
Dragon's Lair
was, like, crazy.
It was basically all of our first time being disappointed by QuickTime events.
Pretty much. And yet they're still alive in games. Yeah. What the hell?
Yeah, and it was based on LaserDiscs, which is...
Yeah, so it looked really cool, but yeah, there's not a lot of game there.
We finally have the technology to do a real-time Dragon's Lair that looks like a cartoon, I'd say.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
But...
You know, nobody wants to.
Will it be any better as a game?
No, but I think it's funny that it took that long, because it was just essentially a ruse, mm-hmm. just having, you know, pre-rendered cartoon clips that play... and change on command like a tree.
You'd want to adapt it to something, if you did it these days, to something with an actual, like, you know, sword play system that you could control for real, which you could probably do now.
We could make it like Dark Souls. That'd be really cool.
Dark Lair.
There's that Xbox shooter coming out that's very cartoon.
Oh, Cuphead?
Cuphead, yeah.
Yeah.
At least done the style. Cool. You know, it's a totally different kind of game, but it's doing that style where it looks exactly like a cartoon would have looked on TV.
There is a very cartoon-looking Dark Souls-ish game coming out called Momodora 5. It's nothing like any of the other Momodoras so far.
Okay.
It's not, like, the animation is not quite as good as Dragon's Lair, but it's really getting there. And it is much more substantial as a game than Dragon's Lair was.
Yeah.
But you have to admit, Dragon's Lair was very impressive. It made a good impression.
Well, so speaking of things that look good in arcades, this would have been later. But one of my memories of one of the first times I remember being, like, really blown away by graphics is when I walked up to Altered Beast in an arcade.
Oh, yeah. I love that
which,
game.
Which, yeah. And then I try to go back and play it now, and I'm like, this game is not that fun, really. But
it was exciting because of the way it looked.
Yeah,
the graphics just were damn good at the time.
The huge sprites were just really amazing.
And the transition where he turns from a human, you know, it gives a screen where you're blinking and turning into a wolf or whatever.
Although the other disappointing thing going back to it today compared to your memories now is I actually was reminded of this because Kishi on the forums did screen caps of it. But so the first time you do the human to wolf transition, there's this really detailed full screen sprite art transition.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Right. But then all the other animals, the transition is like 2 or 3 frames.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. It's like they like cheaped out on like they do this really cool one for the first time you see it. That's this great animation.
That's the one everybody sees.
That's the one you remember. Mm-hmm. And then all the other animals you can transform into, it's actually a really simplistic like splash screen that you get
from your grave
for the transformation.
Yeah, that's a really sort of common cheat that a lot of game designers have always used, where they like front load really cool stuff, and then maybe the very end is really cool, but everything in between is just kind of like, meh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
They do that in music too, like on albums. I'm not kidding. It's a strategy. Yeah. You know, the best songs first and last, especially the last thing you hear is supposed to be something good that people remember.
So then you want to like play it again
or buy it or
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of arcade games definitely had that, the really cool stuff up front.
Mm-hmm.
Suck you in.
Just kidding. You made a list of things you remember, like Punch Out and arm wrestling. Those are worth talking about because those were awesome. We've had a Punch Out episode, but we didn't really focus that much on the arcade. It was more about the home console ports. But that was like, to me, those games were a lot more impressive than Dragon's Lair because you actually played them.
Yeah.
They were not, you know, just like, here is a cartoon that we created and you can press a button and maybe die. But, you know, like you were actually getting in there and punching a guy and there was an announcer saying, body blow. Yep.
Yeah. I remember that. That was during a period where I guess, you know, home consoles started replicating the arcade experience with a joystick. And so the greatest thing about arcades was that you could make these interesting interfaces like we kind of talked about before. That's a Santa Monica bus token. I don't know where that came from. Okay.
We talked about sitting in a cockpit
or, you know, like the punch out where you have a joystick for each hand. You're physically pushing them forward like you're punching. And the arm wrestling game was that a Nintendo game? I don't even remember who made it, but it was just crazy. Yeah, it was huge, based on the plastic punch out hardware. And was it the one with the arm?
Mm-hmm.
There's one with a huge plastic arm and you could physically arm wrestle it. Like it was
Seeing that. I think I was too small to play it.
Yeah, I was too. Yeah.
I think I tried to play it once, but it scared me. It's like, is it going to break my arm off? Because it's a machine, you know? Yeah. I have no idea.
And that was, again,
that much force feedback.
Yeah.
It was in that transition from bar games, because it was really like a test your strength kind of thing.
They kept that right next to the love tester machine in the Pistol Pete's.
Exactly, yeah.
The Punch-Out had a dual screen thing. It had a, you know, upper and lower monitor, which is neat. And
I believe that game was designed specifically because they had a surplus of monitors or something. And
they wanted to use up.
We need to use all these monitors.
Wow,
that could be apocryphal, but I believe that's where it came from. And that was something that they lost in the, in the transition to the home console. But they still kept that design when they created the PlayChoice 10, because you had like the game monitor below, and then you had the system monitor above, and you could like swap between games on your 3 minutes per quarter and kind of like cycle through. If you got, 30 seconds into Castlevania, were like, where's Dracula? This is stupid. I want to play Mario instead.
You could swap. Yeah.
You do that.
Short attention span.
But I'm kind of jealous that because Japan still gets some of these weird physical games set up. So like there's the Fist of the North Star game that came out not that long ago. It probably was a while ago now, but where it has like six different targets for you to do your wah-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta's on. Wow. And then there's the table flip game.
Yes, the table flipping game is amazing.
The table flip where you have
There's almost nothing to it. You pay a dollar for like a 30-second experience, but they really milk it for everything that it's worth.
I can do that right here.
That's not
do not flip the table.
So have you ever seen this tea table game?
Chris Kohler told me about it when I was in San Francisco. I was like, are there any cool arcades in town? He's like, well, there's one in
the one
Japantown that has the table flipping game, and I didn't get a chance to go there. So
I don't really know exactly how you can tell when you're supposed to flip the table, but the controller is just a table and things happen on the screen. And at some point you like flip the table, you like throw the actual table controller up, and then everything on screen slows into slow motion and things fly off the table, and it like creates combos as the stuff
I think it's measuring the force you flip the table.
It's ridiculous. And there's almost nothing to it, but it's very satisfying to play once or twice.
That sounds cool.
There's some other cool games. There was a recent Galgo 13 game where you actually are looking, it was kind of like Silent Scope in the arcade, where you are like looking through a rifle sight and trying to take out specific targets with certain goals and things. So you still see like, there was Elevator Action Death Parade. Did you ever see that?
I haven't seen that.
It's probably been like 10 years since that came out, but there's like this crazy elevator door element to it where like the doors open and it's kind of a first person shooter. And when the doors open, you have to like gun down dudes.
So it has like physical doors.
Yes. It has physical doors that move away from the screen.
I don't want to be in that parade.
But it's the fun parade. You can be the marshal.
Fun death parade. No, so recently there have been these app-based arcade games. I don't know if you've been to an arcade recently, but I take my kids to them. There's a Flappy Bird.
Where are there arcades?
I heard about that.
Well, at the beach. We go to the arcade.
Hmm.
You know, that's about it. At the beach. So there's a Flappy Bird machine. Actually, I've seen them at Chuck E. Cheese in Raleigh. There's still a Chuck E. Cheese here. I've been.
Where's there a Chuck E. Cheese?
It's on Capitol Boulevard.
Oh, okay. So that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's the same. That used to be a Showbiz when I was a kid, and then they turned it. But a lot of these games incorporate gigantic LCD TV, you know, or monitor that's vertically oriented or something. I even saw a Fruit Ninja with a touchscreen that was like this big.
Oh, I've seen that one. Yeah.
Wow. You know?
So it's interesting what they're doing these days, and everything, just about everything is a ticket redemption game. And then there's one like 60-in-1 poor gutted Miss Pac-Man sitting in the corner and like, why would I play that? You don't get any tickets.
So, so if you're really good at Flappy Birds, you can get a million tickets now?
Yeah, you can. If you keep going, you have to push a button, but man, it's hard. I tried to play it.
Yeah, there's a roller rink I've been to here in town that has a pretty decent selection of arcade games and redemption games. Mostly older games, because I think it's meant more for the parents while their kids skate. So the parents have something to do that doesn't involve, you know, breaking their tailbones.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, my last time actually just organically running into arcade games here in Raleigh was very sad. You said I posted the pictures from it. I was just went to some like bar restaurant, and in the back there was a room that had some games in it, and the biggest thing there was this, like, you know, 100-in-1 arcade game that was clearly some crappy emulator.
Yeah,
that was just set up in a box.
I see there's a lot. They do a horrible job. They rip out all the guts and they put a new panel in and nothing matches, and there's an LCD monitor and one of those, you know, Chinese boards that you can buy on Amazon for like $30.
Yeah, it had like Dig Dug and stuff on it and other things, but it was all very sad looking.
So that's actually probably the biggest threat to arcade heritage today is those conversions.
Yeah. Where people are gutting actual cabinets.
Mm-hmm. Some people have done, you know, I've read horror stories about, you know, actual really rare games that have been ripped out and converted.
Yes.
There is a barcade downtown, the Boxcar.
Yeah, I've been there. It's really cool.
I haven't been there because I lived like a block away, but they hadn't opened it yet. And then they opened like a month after I moved here. So
it's fun. It's good.
I need to go. We should go record an episode there. See if they'll let us.
I keep meaning to go to the one in Chapel Hill too, the Baxter Barcade that I keep meaning. I've been like right next to it and haven't actually managed to spend time there.
Barcade has a really good Mario Brothers machine. So I love Mario Brothers because it's one of the best co-op arcade games in my opinion. And it's semi-competitive.
I just played that at a Long Island Retro Expo, like the original arcade game. And after so many years of playing the NES version or like the Game Boy Advance rendition of the NES version, it was nice to play the original arcade game and see all the little details that didn't make it into the NES conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Like the turtles flipping over and the kooky animations on the fireballs.
Yeah,
and the fireballs have this weird glow to them or something, don't they? That's different.
The coins, too.
Yeah.
There's like this really subtle effect that they have. Something with the palette cycling. It's really cool.
Huh.
It's amazing.
Just a very, very subtle
effect. Boxcar is great.
Gotta try that again.
We should go there.
So that does seem to be kind of the state of things for arcades these days. Is
alcohol. Redemption.
I mean, it's kind of going back to its origins. And, you know, redemption machines and stuff for drunks to do.
Yeah.
But
it's fun, though. It's so much fun.
So I'm just looking at Ben's list if we want to, like, jump back in time again.
Sure.
Yeah, I think maybe we should take a pause here and then make this a whole episode, go back into it. Because there's still the whole 90s and DDR and all that crazy stuff.
Yeah,
we didn't even talk about the X-Men thing with three monitors or
I think it was one. We'll talk about that after the break.
Two. Three.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
Do you want to save more money? Sure, we all do. And if you're a Retronauts listener, odds are you play a lot of video games. So if you want to save money and play even more video games, then you definitely need to hear about our new sponsor, Gamefly. Gamefly is the best way to buy and rent video games. All of your favorites are there, and you can have them mailed directly to your door. That's right, no more venturing out into an uncaring world for you. Now, there's a reason Gamefly is the leading video game rental service. With over 9,000 titles to choose from, Gamefly lets you try your favorite games and movies before you buy, and you can keep the games as long as you want. Plus, you'll never have to worry about late fees, and you can cancel at any time. And I speak from experience, folks. I used Gamefly for 5 years when I was a nightmarishly poor college/grad student, and I have nothing but nice things to say about the service. So if you want to check out Gamefly for yourself, go to gamefly.com/retronauts and start your free premium 30-day trial today. This premium trial allows you to check out two games and or movies at a time. You can only get this offer by visiting Gamefly.com/Retronauts. Now go and sign up and start playing all of your favorite games absolutely free for 30 days. That's Gamefly.com/Retronauts.
I have never had much luck gambling. I won $8 once on a scratch-off lotto card someone gave me as a stocking stuffer a few years ago, but I forgot to redeem it. The trick to a good gambling experience, besides never counting your money when you're sitting at the table, of course, is to play the odds on what you know. Me, I couldn't tell you the first thing about who's favored to win this week's big game, but I can tell you that if you want to put money down on your burning sports hunch, the place to do it is mybookie.ag. MyBookie has been in this biz for years, and they have a solid reputation. They offer 100% cash bonuses and quick payouts for winners. Just 2 business days. They also offer in-game live betting. They promise the most rewarding player perks in the business. And they've launched an all-new mobile site for wagering on the go. Join now and MyBookie will match your deposit with up to a 100% bonus. Just use the promo code RETRO, R-E-T-R-O, to activate your offer. So if you're in the mood to make a wager, just go to mybookie.ag, where you play, you win, you get paid. Remember to gamble responsibly, and be sure to check your local regulations first. As we dive into the second half of this, what apparently is going to be a full episode on our arcade memories, I have a bunch of reader comments, people who have written in to share their memories of arcade gaming, and that's awesome. So we're going to do listener mail.
Hit it, boys.
So from Yakov Grinberg, I spent a lot of time in 89 to 90 as a little kid going to the local arcade in Leningrad in the Soviet Union, where the only real video games, the ones that weren't electromechanical, were barely out of the Atari 2600 graphics gameplay era. When we moved to America in 91 and I went to an arcade the first time and saw Street Fighter II, it was like I had stepped out of a time machine. I never experienced the slow progression into that kind of graphical fidelity and sound. So it was this jarring, amazing experience. And for the next few years, I ended up spending as much of my free time in the arcades as I could. That's awesome.
That is really cool.
From Jacob Proctor. The closest thing I had to an arcade when I was a kid was a couple of cabinets in a pizza place. They had Rampage and Gauntlet Dark Legacy, which remain two of my favorite games. So this kid is pretty young.
Yeah.
These were both two-player games, and it was great spending all the quarters I could get a hold of playing with my sister. A few years later, we would go to a laser tag place that had the holy grail, at least for me, Time Crisis 3. Man, that game was so good. Back when I was living in Michigan, my girlfriend at the time and I would go to the Pink Elephant Arcade in Lansing and just play that game over and over. Time Crisis 3.
Three?
That was the good one.
Okay.
Because that was the one where they added the automatic weapons and stuff. It was more than just like the regular guns.
Hmm. And do they shake when you shoot them?
They did have like the... the solenoid or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't think cool. I played that one. I remember putting a significant amount of time into Rampage back in the day. Yeah. I think actually one of the Pizza Huts had Rampage.
This may be Rampage remake. If he's talking about Dark,
Dark Legacy, it's probably like
there was a
3D.
So the original Rampage. Like, there's not a lot of game there, but it's just so satisfying.
I love that game.
I would put credit just to knock the buildings down over and over.
Well, that was one where it was fun to play with another person because you could be dicks to each other. And then you could even eat the other person when they lost. You could, like, they would turn back into a human and make a human and, like, slink off the screen. And you could go over and grab them and hit them. It was just, like, such an insult to someone, but it was really fun.
I love that game.
And Gauntlet is one that, not Dark Legacy, I don't think that I've ever played that, but the original Gauntlet is one that I remember from that putt-putt I was talking about. Like, that was the first time I played that was at that birthday party that I mentioned. So 1985, 86, I guess. I wanted to play that, but it was very expensive because it kept eating my quarters.
Yeah, Your health ticks down.
Everything attacks you, and your health ticks down on its own. Very douchey.
I love the theme. Neat. Gauntlet's one of my favorites. Definitely.
Anyway, back to the letter. I recently got set up with a PVM, a cathode ray tube television, primarily so that I could play light gun games. And I can always play this one for a few minutes. I need to set up more light gun games on my system, for sure. Every game I had an arcade experience with became one of my all-time favorites. And I wish there were arcades close to where I live. I would like to build an emulation arcade cabinet at some point, and I know exactly what my first three games would be.
Buddy won't tell us, or she.
I'm pretty sure it's going to be the games that he mentioned.
Oh, this is the same
letter? Same letter, yeah.
We stopped in the middle.
We got distracted, but that's okay. From Chris Bruce. When I was about 10, around 1995, my parents took me to Disney World. My best memory from the trip was Sega's Innoventions Pavilion at Epcot. It was a giant arcade with kiosks for the Genesis, possibly early Saturn, and the company's whole lineup of arcade games. The one that I remember most was a giant Formula One game setup with multiple players competing at once and a live announcer calling the race. I remember briefly being in first, but eventually falling back to third. My dad cheered me up by telling me that in a real-world F1 race, that position would still have been worth $500,000 in prize money. I just looked it up, and the game was apparently Virtua Formula, an expanded version of Virtua Racing.
Wow.
So I have never heard of that one.
Yeah, haven't played that one.
I can't imagine that, like, Formula One, no one in America really cares about it. So it was probably huge in Europe, and there's people who are like, oh yes, I remember playing Virtua Formula on my ZX Spectrum. But that's not me.
It's like everybody thinks Tomb Raider is the greatest game of all time in England.
And they get angry if you don't say Lara.
Yeah, I did. Well, that's a story for another time.
But that letter reminds me of another place I did go to arcades when I was little, is a few times at Disneyland, because I had relatives out in California, so we'd go to Disneyland. And they did have a pretty big arcade there back in the 80s.
In Disney World?
That's why it was the happiest place on Earth.
Yeah.
From Mila. I thought I'd share my favorite arcade memory. It's probably later than most submitters, in that it happened when I was in high school in the late 90s. My parents had decided to go see Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor, while I, being ahead of the crap-sensing curve, saw something else at Morristown Mall's movie theater. There was about an hour's difference between the movie's runtimes, so I decided to spend the wait at the now-gone arcade near the food court. I've always been a sucker for fighting games, especially 2D ones from Capcom and SNK, and I was extra delighted to find a new Darkstalkers game. It was the third one, so apparently there had been one I missed. Around this time, there was only one person working in the arcade, a bored-looking man around college age. As I started playing and trying out a few of the characters, he just sort of milled around and would occasionally peek over to my shoulder to see how I was doing. After a few rounds, I decided to try the last of the new characters, B.B. Hood. I knew a character who looked like Little Red Riding Hood was going to be interesting to play, but the moment I attacked and this character whipped out a machine gun, I burst out laughing. I'm usually pretty shy about stuff in public, so it was a completely random reaction. Next thing I know, the employee is next to me, giving me free tokens and laughing himself. I apologize for my outburst, but he just laughed and told me to enjoy myself. It's probably not as fun as other anecdotes you'll get, but it was a key moment for me getting a little self-conscious about myself and finding a favorite game in the process. From Dan Fight, I could talk about arcade memories for hours, but perhaps my favorite moment from the arcades came in 1994. I was playing Mortal Kombat 2 at the Sawmill Multiplex in suburban New York, and I was putting on a show. I was never very good at Mortal Kombat 2, but when I was lucky enough to have a string of weak opponents, I could dazzle spectators because I knew all the characters and fatalities by heart. So I could choose Shang Tsung over and over and just perform lots of showy, gory moves over and over by morphing into every other fighter. At some point after my win streak reached double digits, I was stunned to see that the tiny crowd of spectators included famed comedian Robert Klein. In the 90s, Klein wasn't exactly a star, but I was the kind of kid who watched tons of stand-up on cable, so I recognized him even when most my age would never have. Presumably he was there with his son, and he was just waiting for him to finish playing, but he definitely watched me and play and said, "You're pretty good to me," when he left. I can never recall another time in my life when a parent praised me for playing a video game, and this was a famous person.
That's neat. Cool story.
He kind of mentioned in here the fact that movie theaters tended to put you up against a very random succession of opponents, usually not very good. And I definitely have memories of playing Street Fighter 2 and just wanting to play solo and little kids coming over and putting in quarters to play against me. And I'm like, I don't want to just destroy you, but on the other hand, I was playing on my own, and it's kind of rude to just walk up. But on the other hand, you're like 9 years old. So there's always this kind of conundrum. Like, do you just destroy the kid and be a jerk?
Or do you let the kid have a round?
Do you let the kid win? What do you do? So
arcade etiquette.
Yeah. What is the etiquette there?
I think you've got the right idea. Just don't destroy them so they can feel happy and then beat them.
I mean, that's what I did. I destroyed them in one round. Then I let them have the second one just barely. And then the third round, I basically played hard to get and tagged him a few times. So I won like with a timeout. I feel like that was probably the nicest way to do it. But at the same time, I didn't feel like too much of a jerk about it. And he wasn't happy, but his mom was like, whatever, kid.
Yeah. Whatever, kid.
From Jeff Byram. I remember going to our exhibition center with my parents for the various home and garden shows. What always made the trip worthwhile for me was the tiny arcade setup they had in the middle under a giant Ferris wheel. It was the only time I got to see or play Killer Instinct on the real arcade hardware. I was never very good at it, but it sure helped pass the time. So, that's one of the things that it's really hard to get across is just the fact that arcade cabinets were everywhere back in, like, the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were. It's amazing. Everybody wanted to make money on them. There's a time when they would pull in, like, $10,000 a week or something like that, I read, in the early 80s. So people wanted, you know, they wanted that extra income. Convenience stores and everything, and the operator would take a cut or whatever, you know, whoever had to own the machine and put it there, but then the store owner could get a certain percentage of it, which is cool.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
How many machines do you have to bring in $10,000 a week?
Just one machine could do that.
What?
I'm not kidding.
This has to be like the perfect location.
$1,300 a day.
When they were new. Yeah, I mean, how many quarters is that?
That's almost 5,000 quarters. That's a lot of quarters.
I'm talking the golden age.
I don't know if that's actually physically possible to do. 5,000
5,000 quarters in a machine?
24 hours?
Okay. It was a lot of money, though.
You can probably do it with a handful of machines, though. Like at their peak popularity.
Yeah.
But I just definitely see it. Like,
they were raking in the dough. I mean, when they were new arcade games, you know, were novel and interesting, late 70s kind of.
They must have really hated people who, like, knew the Pac-Man patterns.
Who were good.
Yeah.
Or who could play, you know, Defender for 10 hours on a single quarter.
Well, that's the reason why, you know, the Miss Pac-Man guys came into being, who create a hack of Pac-Man to make it so you couldn't play the whole game on one quarter because it has random elements and the mazes change and stuff. So
yeah, it doesn't have the pattern.
There's a big market for those aftermarket modifications. And I've done a Miss Pac-Man article on Fast Company, too. Another plug.
Not surprised to hear that. Adrian Pieper. My favorite memory of the arcade is the sound of it as a whole. When I was growing up, it's something that I took for granted, walking into this noisy room with hundreds of sound effects going off at the same time. As arcades disappeared from where I live, my only source for this piece of nostalgia is attending retro gaming conventions like the Midwest Gaming Classic.
Yeah, they had their own sound. That's definitely true.
From Joseph Koenig. I was a total arcade rat growing up and saw the decline of the industry firsthand by the time I was going through high school. Still, I love reminiscing about those days and hope you'll enjoy my rambling, even if those stories don't make it to the podcast. Beating the six-player Konami X-Men game with a new group of strangers every Thursday evening when my dad would take me to the local arcade. Of course, there was no shortage of beat-em-ups around, but none of them had the novelty value and cultural cachet of playing six mutants at once, including the best, Dazzler.
Dazzler
was awesome.
Yeah.
I know you wanted to talk about the X-Men arcade game.
I mean, there's one, the six-player one has at least two monitors.
Right?
It may have been three.
I think three was exclusive to Taito. I think they did that with Darius and Ninja Warriors.
I don't know, but either way, it was awesome. I mean, it stretched across, I think it was three screens. I'm not I'm pretty sure.
Well,
the biggest
will,
one.
Someone will write in to correct.
There were some,
wrong.
You know. Well, we could look it up right now if we want to.
Could,
in,
but
whip that.
Why break the flow of the conversation with Google?
Yeah, right. Well, we can edit it. Okay. 10 minutes
Speak
has passed.
For yourself.
Now we just.
You're not the one doing the editing.
No, that game was great. I mean, it's just that's probably the greatest beat 'em up arcade game. There's just something about it, the way it flows, the way, you know, it has these appealing characters and appealing enemies. And there's also the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game. It was really good.
Yeah, we've talked about the X-Men game on the show before, and the consensus is that it was meant to tie in with, like, it came out around the same time as Pride of the X-Men, that cartoon.
Yeah.
And that's why you get that very specific mix of characters, because by the time the game actually came out, like, those characters were not the active roster for the X-Men. Like, Dazzler had vanished a long time before that.
Yeah.
So you had, like, Wolverine, Colossus, Dazzler, Nightcrawler.
Cyclops,
and Storm, right?
Storm. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, and Storm was in her, like the sort of silver outfit. She had,
yeah.
Was that after the punk phase? I think it was.
I don't know, but it's a great game.
It took some liberties, though. Like, Wolverine shooting lasers from his claws.
Yeah, that doesn't
I didn't know X-Men at the time when I first played the game, but the game got me interested in X-Men. So then I started reading the comics and I went back to the game and was like, wait a minute.
Yeah, wait a minute.
What's going on here? Wolverine can't do that, bub.
I played, you know, we were talking about Boxcar. The last time I was at Boxcar, I played, you know, through that two-thirds of that game on one token. I got bored and I had to hand it off to somebody else because it was just taken for, like, I was. So it's a game you can play through. They may have had a difficulty setting, you know, dip switch changed or something. But anyway,
for some reason,
it's a cool game.
For some reason, the fancy beat 'em up in that vein that I remember playing the most is Simpsons, which is weird because I never actually watched The Simpsons back then.
Yeah, I didn't like The Simpsons,
but
the game was great.
Yeah, it was very eye-catchy. It just had a whole lot of really great animations.
That's a good game, too.
Yeah.
Bob has talked extensively about all the Simpsons games.
I'm sure he has.
I've heard about that.
So I wouldn't even dream of adding my two cents because I have nothing valuable to add to his extensive knowledge.
Although I do remember it has the thing where if you electrocute Marge, you see the bones in her hairdo.
No, you see the rabbit ears.
Oh, the rabbit ears, that's right, from the old designs. Yeah,
yeah, like when she was going to be a life
the Life
and
Hell designs. Yeah, that's right.
Cool.
Back when Simpsons was weird and fun. So back to, whose letter was this? Joseph's letter. Seeing Street Fighter 2 for the first time and becoming immediately obsessed, then growing to love fighting games even more as Mortal Kombat and Virtua Fighter appeared, culminating in a Marvel vs. Capcom 2 habit that could have paid for a year of college. I do remember the first time I saw Street Fighter 2. I was on a school trip to San Antonio and was just like walking around the Riverwalk with some classmates, and we stopped into this small arcade, and I was just like, what is this? It's crazy. I remember seeing a fight in Dhalsim's level, and there were like elephants doing stuff in the background while I was fighting, and there's these huge characters beating the tar out of each other. It was amazing. I was instantly obsessed with that game.
They had one of them, Street Fighter 2, at a video rental store near my house. And at the time Street Fighter 2 came out, I remember thinking arcades were done at that point. They were not very popular, and it definitely gave them a new lease on life,
The
one-on-one fighting genre.
I guess I didn't have that sensation that arcade games were not popular, but that could just be because my friends and I went to arcades a lot, and there was no shortage of you know, new games coming out around then. You had a lot of the you know, the beat 'em ups like Final Fight, and you had stuff like Magic Sword, which was kind of like a beat 'em up but kind of not, and you had shooters and you had fighting games, and
yeah, so it's just based on my perception, because it must have been during a period where we didn't go to arcades anymore and we were focusing on home consoles.
No, I think you're right. I think arcades were fading. Yeah, they were, and then, you know, Double Dragon and Final Fight kind of gave them a lift, and then Street Fighter 2 gave them a huge lift, but it also changed the makeup of what arcades were like.
Double Dragon. There's this, we moved to a new house in 87, and there's this kid down the street. He said, hey, over at the Hop Inn, which is this gas station, they've got this new game called Double Dragon. It's so awesome. You gotta go play it. And I was like, whoa, Double Dragon. So yeah.
Can any game contain the coolness of two dragons at once?
Double Dragon. Yeah, I wanted to play it, and I don't think I ever played that in the arcade, except maybe recently, you know.
Yeah, it was one of those that I did not see in arcades until after I had
played on
wrung
the
NES version inside and out.
I loved it on the NES.
Yeah, and the arcade version was so weird to go back to after, you know, mastering the NES version because everything looks different.
Yeah.
And basically all you do is elbow smash people and you've got two people playing at the same time, but the frame rate is like crazy bad. If you ever go back and watch that video or that game in action, it's like super bad frame rate. It's like, that's not something that normally bothers me in a game, but it's so choppy in this one that it feels almost like, you know, a slideshow or something.
Yeah.
Like a really badly loading animated GIF.
It's funny. I was playing another old game recently. I don't remember what it was, but I was just thinking it had a really bad frame rate. So I guess we're getting spoiled with these modern, fluidly animated platformers and things like that.
Well, for me now, it's, you know, going back and playing old hardware on a PVM and being like, oh, look, everything's so smooth. After seeing years of old video game footage on YouTube, where it was always 30 frames per second, back and like, when I switched my video projects from 30 to 60 frames per second, people were like, whoa, this is weird. Game Boy at 60 frames per second is blowing my mind. And it does make a difference. Yeah. Like it just makes everything look more convincing. It's weird because 3D games, I'm okay with a lower frame rate. But when it comes to older games, I really want that
perfect
60 frames per second.
If you don't synchronize the frame rate of the game or the output of the monitor with the video, you know, it's not gonna, there can be missed frames there.
Yeah.
You know,
they'll have like NES games, you'll have flicker. And if you have things flickering, alternating frames, then if you're only 30 frames per second, you're basically going to have huge chunks of graphics missing. Like, I can't imagine Gradius at 30 frames per second. That would be a disaster. Cause I was trying to put together the latest NES Works book. And getting screenshots of Gradius that work was really hard because that game, even though it looks great in motion, like when you look at it frame by frame, it's constantly cycling through sprites because there's so much on each line and it really pushes the NES beyond its capabilities.
Just has to cycle through them.
So
you have to composite a couple of frames that you
I kind of found places where there's not a lot, you know, the NES is limited how many frames or how many sprites it can display on a single horizontal
scan
line.
So
I just had to find things where stuff wasn't all stacked up on a single row. So like ships are coming from above and below and your options aren't lined up with the Viper and that sort of thing. But it was kind of tough.
Yeah.
So like, you know, you don't notice that at 60 frames per second, but how do we even get onto this? Double Dragon.
This has become a micro episode.
That's fine. Whatever. This is free form. I'm telling you. Back to Joseph's letter. You'll like this one, Ben. When the first DDR machine in the city showed up, DDR USA, and caused the formation of a whole social circle, including teams, competitions, both score and freestyle, and intense teenage rivalries. For the record, my handle was Freefall, and our team name was Zero Gravity. Our website still lives on through the Internet Wayback Machine.
Nice.
Awesome. So this is a thing you did, right?
I never really got into the like team scene or anything in DDR, but I did play it. I played it sometimes in the arcades, and then I got home versions later on, mainly because I could play video games and get exercise, which was kind of a revelation. But the arcade versions of DDR were great with just the sort of tactile feedback of the big buttons to step on. And that definitely was kind of revitalized, added a whole new section to arcades, drew in a whole new crowd.
Yeah, that's true.
That was something that I was never able to do because
I know better
than to make an idiot of myself.
Yeah, I'm too shy to dance.
I can't even play Parappa, so forget about it.
Yeah, you got to kind of not care or be really good, but mostly not care.
But I am grateful that DDR happened because it really did kind of keep the arcades alive, after it was kind of like Street Fighter. Like, it kept them alive for a while longer.
It's a whole new scene that sort of sustained itself for a while.
Yeah, so there were still, you could still find arcades pretty easily up through like 2006, 2007. So like in Lansing and in San Francisco, you know, wherever I lived, I could find an arcade and it was mostly, you know, like kind of dominated by the DDR scene, but then they would have other stuff and that's what I cared about. And as long as it was like, you know, the sort of
table
loss leaders.
Anchor it.
What's that?
Table flipping game.
Sadly, no. But
as long as they have that, I'm happy.
There was a whole, I mean, more so in Japan than over here, but there was a whole, you know, B-Money explosion, all kinds of rhythm games with different controllers. They had the like the para para ones where you like break the light beams with your hands and it's supposed to be kind of like a dance. But wow.
move on to a different letter. That one was kind of long, and there's still more, but that's okay. George Mathis says, I was born in 1987 in rural southeast Michigan. So let's see, that would be south of Detroit. So arcades were few and far between, mostly far away. There was a Western-themed restaurant near me, the Golden Nugget, with an arcade inside of a caboose attached to the building. My two younger brothers and I loved going into the restaurant and pumping our parents' quarters into the random smattering of machines. They got to eat and drink with friends peacefully, and we got to lose at 1943, Double Dragon, and Pinball. As I got older, and the Golden Nugget closed up shop, the go-kart track became the high school destination for DDR. A few friends and some locals would crowd around on the weekends. I was never that good, but it was more about the social aspect, the experience, and watching people sweatily glide through the hardest difficulties.
Wow. See, I thought the whole idea of video games is you didn't have to move your physical body to play them.
Well, this is why it's a whole new crowd.
So, yeah. I'm joking, though.
I do miss when, you know, like there would just be dedicated rooms for the kids to go off to and play video games. And
Yeah. They still, don't they, you know, bowling alleys still have arcades. That's the last time I went to an arcade in Raleigh other than Chuck E. Cheese, I guess.
They took the bowling alley out of UNC. There used to be a few arcade machines down there.
There was
a bowling alley in the below the student union, and there was, there was a smattering of machines down there.
There's a bowling alley on Hillsborough Street that was legendary. I think it's gone and it's going to become a Target. So there you go.
So, you know, I graduated from high school in 1993, so you could still find arcades pretty easily back then. And the very, like the last, I guess, 2 weeks of my senior year, the school was kind of like, you guys are done, so you only have to go half days, which was amazing. Like, I don't know if every school does that, but ours did, and it was the best. So for like the last 2 weeks of our school careers, they were just like, all right, it's lunchtime, go home. So my friends and I would go over to, there were a couple of bars that had arcades, and during the day they didn't really, you know, it was fine for kids to go, and it was like 21 plus at night, but in the afternoon it was just like, come on in and play video games. And so there were a couple of different locations around town. The Copper Caboose is what it was called. And so most days, my senior year, like my last 2 weeks of high school, my friends and I would just go and play Magic Sword and Pit Fighter and whatever else, you know, Street Fighter, obviously, whatever was popular in arcades right around then. And we weren't the only ones with the same idea. Like friends that I'd had in elementary school or junior high who went to different high schools than me, I hadn't seen them for years. They showed up too. They were all like, I was like, hey, what's up? I haven't seen you since sixth grade. Let's go play Street Fighter together.
Hey, Jeremy, your voice has changed.
All of us had, you know, changed voices by that point. But yeah, like I miss that sort of, you know, the social scenes.
Yeah, that's true.
Just the random, like, here's a magnet for people with like interests. You don't get that with arcades anymore because there aren't any more.
Yeah. Redemption.
Who can redeem the arcade?
Mm.
All right. From Noah Piasek. I have many fond arcade memories. Finishing six-player X-Men with friends at a birthday party. Encountering a super early version of Mortal Kombat 2 at a hotel in New Hampshire. Finding Super Mario Bros. 3 on a PlayChoice machine in Mount Kisco. Man, like, I had that experience. Not in Mount Kisco, but
yeah,
seeing that game before it came out on a PlayChoice.
And being
like,
really?
Oh, nice. Why are the turtles so big?
I saw it on Wizard, the movie. First.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, well, before the release of The Wizard.
Before The Wizard,
even. Wow.
And my first encounter with Dragon's Lair and Space Ace at a mini golf course in Connecticut. It's fun to think about. But my favorite memory is my first finding and playing of Pac-Mania in 1987.
Huh.
Pac-Mania.
Good game.
Like, that's not one you can really hear people talk about.
Well, there was a Pac-Mania machine in Gatlinburg, and I played it every single time I went to. We'd go every spring break to visit my grandma who lived in Eastern Tennessee. So we had stopped by Gatlinburg and I played that game a lot.
Wait, okay. Great. Refresh my memory. Which one is Pac-Mania?
It's the isometric version.
Yes.
Okay,
pseudo,
yes.
3D kind of.
Yes.
You can jump over the ghosts.
Yeah, you can jump.
But when you hit jump, everything jumps.
No, you can jump without. It's not.
When I played it, jumps. Like I press jump and everything goes whoop. Like all the bad guys jump too.
That's some other hack you've played or something.
That's the Namco Museum version.
Okay, well that one's screwed up because nobody at Namco remembers what the original game was like.
I only have vague memories.
I saw that for the first time at the same trip to San Antonio that I encountered Street Fighter 2.
That's cool. And I remember, like, when were you in San Antonio? I've been there once.
Oh, it was maybe probably like 1992, 93. It was late in high school.
At the same time, there's this guy. Look kind of like you.
Was it around spring break?
No. I was actually like 97.
I was there because I'm a nerd for a math and science competition.
Okay.
That's how I spent my birthday that year. It was great.
Very cool.
But yeah, I remember seeing that in the arcade and being like, what the hell is this? Pac-Man's weird now.
Yeah.
I love this that game.
That would have been 1991 or 92. So by that point, Pac-Mania was pretty old. So I didn't even know it existed before that. I guess it didn't make it.
I like it because you can jump over the monsters because you can have an escape. You don't get cornered. So
right.
It's not as cerebral, but also you can't see the whole maze.
You don't like
the
those
same.
Cerebral games. Yeah, I know you.
Not competitive. Nothing that's actually hard. No challenge.
That's fine. That's fine. We're gonna hack a custom Dark
like
Souls
walking
for you,
simulators.
Where you like look at a bad guy and they die.
I like walking simulators.
Dim Souls. I haven't actually played any walking
strolling
simulators,
through
but
a castle.
I just got Windows set up on my laptop, so I think I'm going to start playing more Windows games.
Have you played? Okay, forget
go,
it.
No, go on.
What's that? The Vanishing of Ethan Carter.
I haven't played that.
I love that game.
I played Everyone's Gone to Rapture. That's all right.
I haven't played that one.
But anyways, that wasn't in an arcade.
In 10 years, we can do an episode on those games.
Okay. See you then.
All right. So, finding and playing Pac-Mania. I grew up in Connecticut, but would frequently visit my grandparents just outside of L.A., and there was this monstrous arcade in their area. It was in a building shaped like a castle with three mini golf courses surrounding it. Was that in Aladdin's castle?
I don't know. Sounds weird.
This place blew away all of my East Coast arcades in terms of selection. As a huge Pac fan, 7-year-old me in 1987 was blown away not only by Pac-Mania's isometric-ish POV, not just by the jumping, not just by the way more than four ghosts per level aspect, but it was the music. Whoever ran the arcade ensured that the speakers on the cabinet were turned up to the max. That Pac quarter insert sound was loud as I dropped in my first quarter and had my Pac expectations bar totally raised.
Your Pac expectations?
Pac expectations, that's good. Great Pac expectations. I remember that classic novel.
Pip, bring me the tokens, Pip.
Hey, sir, I would like more quarters. I think that was Oliver Twist, never mind. All right, after a few plays, I had the song to the first level memorized and then whistled it for the rest of the day, to my older cousin's annoyance. She still holds it against me. The song to the second level had more of a cool vibe as compared to the playful, easygoing song on level one. I couldn't whistle that one as easily. This is without a doubt where my love for game soundtracks was born, and my fandom for all things Pac was truly solidified.
I cannot remember the songs. As many times as I played Pac-Mania, I didn't find it memorable enough to remember.
I didn't know it had a second level.
It has a Lego level that looks like Lego blocks. I think that might be the second level. It's really cool.
I think I've seen that.
My favorite Pac-Man game is Pac-Man Collection. No, not Pac-Man. It's the Pac-Man on the Pac-Man Collection on the Game Boy. And it originally came out in the first Namco anniversary arcade thing. It's one of the rarest, neatest things. What is that game called?
Pac-Man Collection?
Yeah.
For Game Boy Advance?
Yeah,
you can get that on Wii U Virtual Console, actually.
I have it on the Game Boy Advance, too. But I'm just saying, it has a port of an arcade remix of Pac-Man called Pac-Man Arrangement. I think it's one of the two Pac-Man Arrangement games. And it's just, that's my favorite version of Pac-Man.
I need to go check that out.
Yeah.
All right. From Nathan Hill, two favorite memories. Going to the mall with my father, mother, and little sister. My mom and sister would head off to the hair salon, and my dad and I would walk up to the arcade. He and I would take turn after turn playing the Star Wars sit-down arcade cabinet.
Yes.
What can I say about that game that hasn't already been said? It goes without saying that it is awesome. However, what makes it stick in my head is my father and I playing it together, trying to beat each other's score, and just the pure happiness of the experience. My father and I always shared a love for Star Wars, and this is just a happy memory. My second is not as emotional, but for some reason it stuck with me. We were camping at a resort near Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and of course they had an arcade near the camp store. All the campground kids could be found either there or at the pool every single day. Anyway, one particular summer I can always picture as my playing Two Tigers and Time Pilot in the arcade while Madonna's Lucky Star played in the background. What is Two Tigers? Is that a shooter?
I have no idea.
I'm not familiar with that one either.
It sounds like Twin Tigers should be the real name. I don't know.
I don't. Is that like a no? That's Tiger Heli.
Tiger Total Plan Shooter. Two Tigers. I don't know. You stumped the retro now.
Dang! Wow.
Ding, ding, ding.
You win a no prize. Yeah. Somehow the music got me into a groove, and I always played better when that song was playing. It got to the point where I would head to the jukebox first and queue up Lucky Star before dropping my quarters into the machine. Even now, more than 30 years later, whenever I hear it on the radio, my mind flashes back to the 80s and that summer spent playing arcade games, checking out the older girls, and just being a kid.
But that's, Star Wars, man, that was one of the things I wanted to go back to, because that was an amazing game.
It was an amazing game. Voice samples,
but and that whole era of vector graphics, just the amazing things they did with vector graphics.
Yeah.
I love
that was another game that I remember from that San Antonio trip. It was like, and these were all at different places. Like, there were all these different little places where you could play video games all along the boardwalk. So all throughout the weekend that we were there doing the math and science competition, we kept bumping into video games. So this was like 10 years after that game came out. And I was like, wow, look at this old game. That's crazy. So I dropped in a quarter and was like, this game is still awesome, even though it's like super primitive looking. It's crazy.
I think this is actually one of the ones I ran into at Disneyland when I was a kid. They had it in their arcade there. And yeah, it's just like the trench run on that. It's so amazing.
You know, I went to middle school with a kid whose father worked on that game.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, nice. And it was in Raleigh. And his dad's name was Owen something. It wasn't Owen Rubin.
Was it Uncle Owen?
Uncle Owen, Aunt Baru. mother's God. Name, Aunt Baru.
Don't go back home, Uncle Owen. It's bad things will happen.
But that blew my mind because I was in seventh grade and I was already big into Atari collecting and stuff back then. This is like 93, 94 or something. So I couldn't believe someone else knew what the Atari 100 was at that time. We talked about it, but his dad had worked at Atari.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just in the other one from that era that you had on your list. It's Tron, which was also amazing.
Tron.
And it's cool in that it had like this whole variety of different like sub games in it, but all done in the same aesthetic.
All of them were like ripoffs of other games, and none of them were actually that good.
Yeah,
but Light Cycles is unique.
It's Snake.
It's not exactly Snake.
It's competitive Snake. Is
you're collecting things, and you get longer and longer.
Right. I mean, you're creating the trail behind you.
Yeah. In Light Cycles, you're just trying to cut off the other guy and make him crash into your trail.
Right, but Competitive Snake does that.
Okay, well, Light Cycles is just
different. It's good.
It's just good.
So the thing is, like, none of the games were original, and all of them were a little on their own, but the presentation of Tron was so good.
Disc was a really good air hockey club.
Translucent blue joystick. Yes. I mentioned that I have one. I have a home Tron joystick that was meant to look like the arcade game.
Nice.
Can you use it for your NES?
It's an Atari thing. I mean, you could always build an adapter if you really want to.
You should use that for everything. Like just Xbox 360, next time Xbox One.
To a party, I'll just pull out a case.
Oh, like what I brought.
A maple wood case.
Like a...
With latches.
Like a Halliburton case.
Yeah.
It's all metal.
Pardon me, guys. It's going to be red velvet lined, crushed red velvet. Pull out my Tron joystick.
That would be so amazing.
You should. I also remember the end being really frustrating, though. The, like, Master Control showdown where you have to, like, shoot through the spinning shield.
I only beat that, like, once or twice.
Yeah, that was really frustrating.
That whole game experience takes, like, 2 minutes. It's like...
They have that at Boxcar.
You go through those things really fast, and then you die. Yeah,
they have that at Boxcar. That's the last time I played it.
Dude, all right, well, we're recording an episode there.
We should. Yeah,
let's bring one of those field recorder... Thanks.
Yeah, we just need to bring this whole setup and be like, hey guys, hope you don't mind.
Set up on
get an extra power plug.
Or three.
Yeah, just two.
Just two.
So Tron was very cool. Doesn't have like a high resolution screen, like 512.
Yeah, because it wasn't because it was doing like, if I'm remembering right, like it was doing a vector graphics aesthetic, but it wasn't actually a vector machine.
Right.
It was drawing these things in raster.
And sometimes you would get games that had like 512 pixel resolution as opposed to 256.
And you kind of needed that to have smooth looking lines drawn in raster. Otherwise, everything would be super chunky.
Yeah, one of the kind of weirder ones that I didn't realize until recently was Nintendo's Popeye. Which has these like super clumsy looking blocky backgrounds, but then all the characters are drawn in 512 resolution mode. So they look very detailed and very precise, like cartoon characters.
It's possible that they were drawn by different boards and overlaid.
Probably something like that.
Yeah.
The NES version does not compare because it's just like standard resolution, but the arcade game.
That's why I'm thinking Mario Brothers, that effect on the fireball is so weird. It feels like it was generated outside of a computer.
I think it's just palette cycling.
Special board.
Like, I remember noticing that and being like, oh, that's really cool. But crazy. I think it's just like the use of palettes.
Okay.
I think you're probably right about Popeye is like there's two different graphical generators or something. Because the backgrounds are so chunky and like super low resolution, like Atari 2600. But then the characters are like double resolution.
We were talking about that on the Sega episode where they could just keep adding boards and processors to make the game more complicated and just overlay the signal, which they couldn't do on a home console.
I mean, they kind of could with add-on chips, you know, like memory mapper chips and that sort of thing. Or, you know, lock-on technology or whatever. most people didn't do that. You only really hear about it with Nintendo stuff.
Yeah, the FX stuff.
But it you know, like basically putting a coprocessor in a cartridge and letting it do the heavy lifting for you.
Like it's super obvious with things like
that. I did a slideshow about game coprocessors.
Yeah.
Did you? Was it on Fast Company?
PC Mag.
Other one.
It's all about
it too complicated for us.
In the Sega, there's a Sega 3D chip for...
Do you have like a central repository for the stuff you talk about?
BingeEdwards.com. There's a gigantic list that scrolls down 5 pages or whatever, 10 pages of everything I've written. And I don't know. I feel like I need to start categorizing things by theme or subject because there's just so many things.
You can start putting together articles that are just like, hey, here's stuff that I referenced in the latest Retronauts.
I think I need to do that
for you.
Yeah.
I think that would be... Because... Like, you keep talking about all this stuff you've done and then there's no way for people to just casually find it.
Yeah. I think I'm going to start doing that. Like a mega post on everything I've written about. Whatever.
Good plan.
Okay.
All right. Here's another letter. We're going to this whole second half is basically just letters, but that's okay because this is all about
culture.
It's all about experiences. Good. So I'm really happy with the way this is turning out, honestly. From Kyle Overby, I went to high school in North Texas in the late 90s, and while a local mall featured a sizable Tilt arcade with a giant pirate ship shooting gallery, the real treasure was knowledge. No, wait, it was a place out past all the DFW suburbs called Tornado Terry's. Out in Keller, Texas, across some railroad tracks, in a metal corrugated building that could generously be called a shed, was me and my friend's favorite arcade. Tornado Terry's business model was charging a flat entry fee, and inside, all the machines were set to free play. They did have some machines that required tokens, like skee-ball.
And you can never leave.
That's right.
Once you go in.
And you just pink champagne on ice all the time. But basically, anything that wasn't designed to dispense tickets was covered by the initial fee. The machines varied from classics like Pac-Man and Galaga to full sit-down cabinets for games like Cruisin' USA. But even the newest ones were a few years old and not in the best condition. Terry's may never have had the latest and greatest, but it did have all the essentials you'd want for a group, including four-player versions of Konami's TMNT, X-Men, and Simpsons cabinets, and a few others that supported three players, like the Alien vs. Predator brawler by Capcom.
Never heard of that
one. Oh, I saw that once in Nakano Broadway in Tokyo. Like some dudes were playing it, and it's like, you know, Street Fighter 2 level quality graphics, but in a brawler version. You play as one of two predators, or you can play as one of two humans. One of them is Dutch Schaefer, you know, Schwarzenegger's character.
Yeah.
And one of them is a Japanese girl named Lin Kurosawa, who has showed up in a few other things.
I've seen videos of this, but I haven't played it.
And you are just beating the stuffing out of aliens.
Final Fight kind of thing? You scroll
around? Yes, very much like Final Fight.
But like dozens and dozens of aliens coming after you.
And you can get like pulse rifles. And I think the predators can turn invisible. It's like each character is very distinct and very cool.
But it's very like hyperactive, almost like shooter levels of tons of enemies coming at you and you're just blowing
them all away. I saw that for the first time a few years ago and was just mesmerized.
Sounds
like, how did I miss this? It is. It's by Capcom. Let's see. Tornado Terry's also had a number of Neo Geo MVS systems, which featured great co-op games like Metal Slug. Even with this bounty of fighting, racing, and brawler games available to us, there was no question about my group's favorite game at Tornado Terry's. It was Bust a Move. The game was set up in a sizable arcade cabinet featuring a large screen and seating for two players. We'd spend hours at this one machine playing rounds of verses with players rotating in and out, occasionally wandering off to play something else for a bit before returning to go for another few rounds. It was our tradition to play this game anytime we went out to Terry's, including the last time a sizable group of us made the trip out during our first college winter break. I haven't been to Tornado Terry's in more than a decade, but every now and then I get nostalgic to see if they are still in business, and every time I check, I'm a bit surprised to discover they still are.
They haven't been swept away by a tornado yet.
Not yet. The price of entry has gone up from $8 to $15, but their very 90s website proudly declares they've been in business for 27 years and are still going.
Wow.
I hope they never go. They never close.
Well, that's great.
That's not bad for all that stuff on free play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like a good business model.
I would freaking go there and spend $15 for an afternoon of being awesome.
It's not bad at all.
Also, I love Bust a Move.
Bust a Move is...
I love that game.
Puzzle Bobble. You mean Puzzle Bobble?
Yeah. It's just great.
Especially in the original version and not Snood.
Yeah, not Snood. Although Snood is one of Steve Wozniak's favorite games. He always talks about that.
Yeah. He just is like, oh, you can play that one on a Macintosh.
Yeah.
I mean, I discovered Snood before Puzzle Bobble. I talked about that on a Puzzle Bobble episode, actually. But Puzzle Bobble is definitely the best.
The best, yeah. I'd never played it in the arcade. I feel like I may have seen it once, but...
I saw it once in the arcades.
You know, I've played just about every other version. I mean, I've played it on arcade emulator, but I just love it.
Finally, one last letter from Rick Moya. The greatest thing about arcades in the 80s was that you didn't necessarily have to go to a dedicated arcade. I did most of my gaming in a bowling alley where my father bowled in a league. We didn't have a home machine until almost the 90s, so this was my first taste of a lot of games, especially when they brought in the PlayChoice 10. In a way, this foretold the shift to Nintendo as the home powerhouse and away from arcades, as people left the pinball table alone and lined up their quarters to get 3 minutes of Super Mario Brothers or The Goonies 2.
Wow.
I prefer the multiplayer experience. Gauntlet, Heavy Barrel, and Quartet were my primary rotation as long as I could team up with someone to attack. The beat-em-up wave was hugely attractive, and when NBA Jam hit, I couldn't get enough of it. Mm. I'd walk to the movie theater near my house, not to see a movie, but just to play NBA Jam on arcade hardware, rather than my less impressive Genesis version. For me, it was always about the communal aspect of gaming. As the arcades went away, so too did my enjoyment of playing. Aside from the occasional session of GoldenEye or Mario Kart 64, we just weren't playing together anymore. Actually, the best thing about the arcade might be the buffet-style offering of different games. I thought I missed playing with others, but when I went back to Japan right after college and found that they still had arcades, I got right back into it, even if I was there by myself. When you buy a game and sink hours into it right away, there's not much chance of being surprised by something different. But in an arcade, especially the multi-story ones in Tokyo, you might turn a corner and see something you never imagined. And for the minimal investment of 100 yen, you can try it and learn new things. Those 2001 Drummania sessions were how I knew I needed to buy Guitar Hero.
Wow. You know, I always felt the PlayChoice 10 was a bad deal because I had an NES at home. Why would I want to play it at the arcade?
Now,
so I don't know why anybody did it.
It was there as a way to check out new stuff.
Check out games you didn't have.
Mm.
Although I sort of had the same feeling, I would gravitate to the SNK multi-game cabs because I sure as heck didn't have a Neo Geo at home.
True,
so that was always
fun. Didn't they have a memory card slot? You could take your game, save game home and put it in your Neo Geo console.
Did they? I don't know.
They did. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know if it worked for every game, but yeah. That was one of the big selling.
Yeah, Neo Geos were ridiculously expensive. So
yeah, they were.
I was never going to have one of those.
$700 in 1980, whatever, whatever.
Yep. So yeah, getting to play like... What am I thinking of? Darkstalkers and... No, that's Capcom.
Samurai Showdown.
Samurai Showdowns. Yes, the Samurai Showdowns and Metal Slug.
I played that at Putt-Putt.
I actually played
Samurai Showdown.
I actually finally played all the way through. I think it was Metal Slug 3 because they had a cabinet on free play at the game room at Animazement here in Raleigh a couple years ago.
It's cool. Yeah, it's a great series, Metal Slug.
I'm not very good at it, but it's great.
It's fun.
But if it's on free play, everyone's good at it.
Yeah, everyone's
true. Although you do kind of lose a little something when you're just like, there's
respawning
no
every 10 seconds. Yeah. But
yeah.
I made it through a lot okay. Towards the end, I was respawning a lot.
As soon as I, in the early 2000s, I bought an arcade home stick that has real arcade buttons and it had two player things. And I set up a MAME, you know, a computer with MAME on it. And the first thing I did is invite my buddy over and we just played through every game we could never get through all the way. Like we did X-Men, we did Simpsons, we did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, we did, Metal Slug, all the Metal Slug games. It was just fun, and then we never played them ever again.
Yeah, I mean, just wanted to see what it was like. Them all the way through. Yeah. Like, I just basically brute forced my way through Final Fight for Super NES, and I don't ever actually want to play that again.
I don't think I've ever seen the end of the Simpsons arcade game. I remember playing.
Probably involves Mr. Burns doing something evil.
Yeah, isn't it like in a mecha or something?
I don't remember. But if you have infinite credits,
he's inside Kraid's robot body.
Yeah.
Krang's, sorry.
Wow.
Krang's.
Anyway, so something. I think we're kind of winding down here, but there are a few things, Ben, you put in the notes that you haven't talked about yet. Kung Fu?
Yeah. Isn't that the IRAM game? Wasn't it done by IRAM? Or?
It was, yeah.
Okay. I just remember seeing it. I always wanted it on the NES, the port of it. I think it was published by Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. It was actually co-developed by Nintendo.
It was? Okay.
Yeah, they did some work internally on it.
I saw that black player's choice book or whatever it's called for the Nintendo, the Kung Fu. I was wanted.
The official Nintendo players.
So when I saw the actual arcade game, I thought it was awesome.
I don't think I'd ever actually seen the original arcade game until like 2 weeks ago.
And there was a Karate Champ too. Karate Champ Data East.
Yeah,
at that same place. Yeah, and well, we played a copy of it called World Karate Championship by Epix on the Atari, which was really good. And so when I saw Karate Champ, I was like, oh, it's just like the other game. But
there was a lawsuit about that.
Yeah, I think so. I remember that.
No, I know there was. It was a kind of look and feel sort of thing.
Yeah.
It helped shape the future of video games.
Yep. Well, that's
Karate Champ's one contribution to video game history. Because it's not actually that great.
Yeah, there's a weird little ref guy in the middle who's like an upside down U. He's just like really.
He does look weird,
looking,
yeah.
You know? I don't know.
It has a weird control scheme where you use like dual sticks as opposed to buttons. Serious. Yeah. So it takes a lot of kind of getting
hard.
Used to.
Couldn't play it.
I never played that one.
All right, let's see.
We've also got like Afterburner on here.
Yeah, Afterburner.
Yeah, we talked about
these.
We
did. Sega.
Afterburner. Yeah.
We're going to talk about Golden Axe in a future Sega episode.
Okay, cool.
But you can spoil it a little now.
I mean, it was. I love the fantasy setting. The graphics are good. It seems like Altered Beast level era graphics. And it's a great co-op game. That's what I love the most about it.
Yeah.
Just play with a friend. And it's just so well done. I don't know. It's the feel of it. There's always this about games, the way the graphics and the sound and the execution of how you play it come together just to make a cohesive experience. And that's one of those games that has that, you know, if you took any one of those elements out, obviously the graphics, but if the sound's not good, you know, and everything else is great, it's just not a perfect game. But if it's got great sound effects and that are satisfying, it's like the coin clinging in Super Mario Brothers. You know?
Yeah. That's one that has a lot of sampling in it. So there's like the little gnomes who come in and steal your stuff while you're between like stages. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of what it has going for it. Because I played Golden Axe with people in college and you play it a bunch and you start to get to the point where there's just not that much to it in terms of the actual game.
But it has
it looks good and it sounds good. And
Yeah, if you play it for 5 minutes with a buddy, you know, at the arcade until you die, it's fun.
Right. And that's why those games are front loaded with content like that, because they just aren't really that substantial.
Yeah.
So you're only going to play for like 5 to 10 minutes.
But you can hop on a dragon and smack things on its tail.
You see everything in the first 10 minutes, but it's okay because that 10 minutes is like, it's so fun.
Yep.
And then you lose interest.
Well, and then you get one more hit when you like finally fill up your magic bar all the way and can do like the top level magic attack, and it fills the screen with crap.
Yeah, I remember that. Great game.
You got Joust on here. That's good. Going old school.
Well, I always loved Joust at home, but I saw it finally in arcade in the early 90s in Gatlinburg, and it was just so hard to just go flap, 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 flap all the time. And I thought, I'm so great at Joust. And, of course, I did that on the button. Like, I don't know what I was playing it on, Atari or something. But just in the arcade, it felt impossible for me to do.
Yeah, I can see that. It does get a little tiring.
I played Defender, too, at that same place. I remember that.
I just played Defender in the arcade for the first time in decades at Long Island Retro Expo, and I forgot that every control is like button based.
Yeah, every single
one. It's like you don't have a joystick. You're like, there's a reverse
forward,
button,
backward.
There's a thrust button, a fire button. I'm like, how? I can't wrap my head around this.
Asteroids.
Jazz Rignall is like apparently some sort of Defender savant and can play for dozens of hours on a single quarter and just like melt down the machine. Like he literally melted the machine once. And I just, I cannot wrap my head around that control scheme. And now I like look back and I'm like, oh, that's why I never played this when I was a kid, because the control scheme is just so difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, the home ports kind of normalize it a bit and probably break the game in that sense, because, you know, if you control it with a D-pad, then
it's different. Yeah.
Everyone can do that.
Or a joystick in my case. I think, Asteroids is all buttons and Lunar Lander.
Atari. Yeah. Lunar Lander. I tried playing that in arcade once. It's so touchy.
The vector,
yeah,
precursor to Asteroids.
Yeah, I just did a Lunar Lander.
There's another video thing I wrote
on Game Boy,
right?
And they tried to keep it authentic, but
man, that sounds
They added some weird stuff to it, like it's kind of based on the Atari game. It's not licensed from Atari, but you know that was kind of like a public domain concept anyway, because mm-hmm. it started out as an academic game.
Yeah.
Add like a section where you lift off on the shuttle and have to take the orbiter up to orbit, and then you release the shuttle, and then after you do the lunar lander part, then you switch to a top down perspective and you walk around the moon digging for ore. It's okay. Kind of weird.
Does it become like Heianchio Alien?
Yes, it does. Actually,
that's great.
I made that comparison in my video.
Wow. Well, in 2009, I did a 30th anniversary of Lunar Lander, and I discovered the guy who created Lunar Lander, Jim Storr, and I contacted him, and I got his source code and everything like that, and nice. I wrote this long article about it on Technologizer. It was one of my big in-depth features where I was looking into the origins of games, and I talked to him and the guy who did it on a GT40 deck system, and then Howard Delman at Atari saw the GT40 version and did it at Atari, and I called Howard and talked to him about that, and it was just fun.
Nice.
So that's another list.
I need to check that out.
Yeah.
Technologizer?
Yeah.
So you really need to put together a list of these things.
Anything you read about Lunar Lander usually goes back to my article. That was like the first one that talked about the
Okay. I did not realize that.
Cool.
Yeah. You're sitting in the room with
damn
a Lunar Lander
the
guy.
Source.
Yeah.
The font of all wisdom.
Font of something.
All right. You've got a mention of Donkey Kong 3 here. No one likes Donkey Kong 3.
That was one of those things that showed up at Pizza Hut when they changed out their machines every few years, and it was in a cocktail version. And it's, you know, you play, what is it, Sid the Bugman or something?
Yeah. Who
is it?
Stanley the Bugman.
Yeah. You're spraying Donkey Kong so he doesn't, and he's dropping beehives on you and stuff. Just... The lack of Mario really... I wonder why they didn't make Mario the guy with the sprayer.
You know, I put some thought into this. And what I noticed is that Nintendo's early protagonists all use a different mode of action. Popeye punches, Mario jumps, and Stanley shoots. Mm-hmm. And I think because they wanted a shooter, they didn't want to put Mario in that role. They kept each protagonist character distinct in that sort of mechanical way. So I think that's... And also, they were spinning Mario off into Mario Brothers. Like, that game shipped within months of Donkey Kong 3.
Mm. And Donkey Kong 3, by the time that came out, Mario wasn't, like, a legendary property, you know, at that time. It wasn't, like...
No, but he was familiar and popular. Like, people liked Mario. You know, when Mario Brothers came out, they had that weird Mario Brothers Car 54 parody commercial. You don't remember that?
No.
Mario, where are you?
Oh, wait, no, okay. I have seen that, yeah.
Yeah?
I've probably seen it on YouTube. Yeah. But the thing is it wasn't anything close to like it was by the time Super Mario 3 came out, for example.
Of course,
and they started sticking him in every game.
Like Pac-Man was.
Yeah.
Donkey Kong was. But they recognized that Mario was kind of like his own thing, so they started to spin him out.
Stanley is not a jump man.
He's a bug man.
He's always pointing up, isn't he, with his... A shooter.
A little shooter.
Yeah.
I guess it just wasn't a dignified enough role for Mario, shooting a monkey in the butt.
Maybe not.
All right, One last thing on your list that you need to talk about. It's one I've talked about a lot.
What is it?
I need a different perspective on it. It's Rolling Thunder.
Oh, yeah. I talked about it a little bit in the Sega thing. Because you compared it to Shinobi.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
I don't know why, but I loved Rolling Thunder just because of the graphics. The sprites were big, and it had a lot of detail, and it just seemed so cool to run around and shoot guys with a gun like a real person in a real thing. And this hood.
Shooting Klansmen.
Yeah.
Neon Klansmen.
The Neon Klansmen with the hoods. Doesn't it have some kind of like close up of the guys with the hoods? Like there's a, in the beginning, like they kidnap somebody.
Yeah. They kidnap Agent Leela.
Yeah.
Who is the playable character in Rolling Thunder 2.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's like a green guy named Malbo or something like that. Something like that, yeah. But he's like this lumpy green alien-looking guy who apparently is the leader of the Hooded Klansmen guys. But have you ever played like more than just the first stage of that game? Because the further you get, the weirder it gets. It starts to kind of go a little kooky once you get to this area with pits of fire. And there's like men made of fire who jump out and attack you. And then you get a little further and there's these man-bat things that like swoop down. They're like giant vampire bats with human faces.
So they're bat supremacists.
I don't even know what they are. It gets weird. I can't make it past that part because the last time I played in an arcade, the machine did not work all that well. It was at Long Island Retro Expo also, and it was not a well-maintained machine. So kind of didn't go left when I needed it to. Also, you don't get continues in that game. Just one quarter.
That was a game where, at the time, I did not know of any home ports of that game. I didn't have it. Me and my brother would always really look forward to playing that game, and we went to the arcade for some reason. We just thought it was awesome. I don't even remember why. Just the graphics.
It's a cool-looking game. It's got style. Yeah. It's got style. And they did bring it out for NES, but it was a Tengen unlicensed game.
Yeah.
So you couldn't just go to Walmart and buy it. You have to find one of those shady rental stores that would offer it.
Yeah. I feel like
this is amazing, you can't do anything like this at home game was the Afterburners.
Yeah, it's Afterburner.
Oh, they did that one at home too on NES from Tengen.
Yeah, we talked about that.
You could not do that at home.
Yeah, no. No, that just didn't work out.
Approved, yeah, but not the one where you could go up and down. We talked about that in the Sega.
No, I mean, the NES version proved that you could not do this at home.
Yeah.
It was a sad attempt. Sorry.
Did I write anything else in the notes? I don't remember. Oh, I've got it right here. I printed it out on paper.
Not about arcade games.
I think
720 at the skateboard shop. There's this big skateboarding boom in the late 80s, 89-ish, and these skate shops started opening up, and they always had a 720 machine, 720 degrees, you know, Atari games game, and that was a cool thing. And I think it had a trackball, right, in the middle, trackball.
It might have. It could explain really why tricky. The NES port is so bad.
Yeah, but I love the NES port, which I have a very small story about that NES port that I'll never be able to tell anywhere else, which is that.
Go for it.
My brother bought 720 for the NES, and he loved it. And he was going to take it to a friend's house, so he put it on the back of my dad's car, like the hood or the trunk or something. And they went to a friend's house, and he's like, "Where's my game? You know, where is it?" And then they realized he left it on the car, and it fell off in the street. And they went back to look at it on the street, and it had been run over. But we took it home and it still worked. We put it in. So I still have this cartridge that's all cracked up on the top part. Because, you know, the circuit board is down at the bottom. We had no idea at that time that there was so much empty space in most Nintendo cartridges.
Yeah.
And so it was crushed, but it still worked. So we played that for years.
So the season finale of Silicon Valley was based on you.
It was? I don't know. I've never seen it. What is Silicon Valley?
It's a TV show.
Yeah, but what's it based on? What is this?
It's based on the fact that, what does that Silicon mean? Valley is full of assholes.
I'm just kidding.
All right. Well, I think with that, we've talked for quite a while. This was a full-length episode, by golly. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. You padded this. I mean, you greatly enhanced this episode.
Gave
us lots of talking
points. I have one more thought.
Okay.
I was just thinking, this might be a good place to add this, which is that, you know, we were talking about some of those early people who wrote in that were younger than us. And
you mean the babies?
Yeah, and there's other people who probably listen to this who are 20 and stuff. And I want to say to them that, you know, you should be welcome in sharing this history and heritage. And because when I was a kid and I tried to get into things that older people did, you know, a lot of them would be like, oh, you're too young to like the Beatles. You know, you weren't there. But that's how cultures die and histories die if you don't pass it on to the next generation. So I hope we can pass on our love of retro gaming to you so you can pass it on to others.
Yeah, I mean, when my nephews come over and they're like, I just want to play NES games. Mm-hmm. Yes, by all means.
Yeah.
I mean, last time my 7-year-old nephew came over, he just wanted to like sit there and go through all the ROMs on my Analog NT.
Wow. Nice.
And
that's great.
I was like, yeah, go for it. He was just basically like looking for games that had interesting names. And he picked stuff that wasn't very good. He was like, Mystery Quest, this sounds interesting. It turns out Mystery Quest yeah. I'd never played it before. It's not good.
Not very good. Is that a Mickey Mouse game?
No, you're thinking of Magical Quest.
Magical Quest. Yes.
Mystery Quest is just kind of a clumsy-ish platformer. It's okay, but it's not great. But no, it was fun. And, you know, he's like, he wants to play zapper games, even though he doesn't quite get the fact that you actually have to aim. He's just like, I'm shooting at the screen. I'm like, well, yeah, but you have to shoot at the ducks. You have to like, look, there's a sight on here. You use it and you like, it's okay. Yeah. He's still young, but I mean, he's enjoying the video games and he contextualizes NES games through Minecraft. He sees them and he's like, you know, these games look like Minecraft. They're blocky and boxy, just like Minecraft. Yeah, and I'm like, okay, if that's what it takes for you to take an interest in this, that's fine. Like, play these old games and, you know, experience something other than just what people are YouTubing. That's great.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you weren't there originally. I mean, no one alive has witnessed the original Beethoven, for example. And someday all the people will say, oh, you're too young to enjoy this.
Mitch McConnell has.
Yeah, maybe him. But
he didn't
everyone
like it,
else.
Though.
Yeah,
he was angry about it.
Yeah. So there you go.
Kill the arts. All right. So anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks those of you who wrote in at the last minute. It was great of you. You made the show better. Ben, thank you both for coming in.
You're welcome.
This, of course, has been Retronauts with me, Jeremy Parrish. You can find Retronauts on iTunes, on Podcast One's network, on the Podcast One app, at Retronauts.com, on Twitter and Facebook as Retronauts. That's RETRONAUTS, not Retronauts as in zero. That's not it. Anyway, that's where you can find us. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, making bad dad jokes and video game references and retweeting angry political screeds. Benj?
I'm Benj Edwards. I'm a writer, and you can find me at BenjEdwards.com and at Benj Edwards on Twitter, and I've got a Patreon, patreon.com/BenjEdwards. And I need your help to keep going with this history stuff. And
I'm Ben Elgin. You can find me as Kirin on Twitter. That's K-I-R-I-N-N. And I also have a blog of old stuff at Kirin's Retro Closet on Tumblr. Only one N in Kirin there. And yeah, that's about it.
And finally, Retronauts, I forgot to mention, is supported through Patreon as in addition to the advertisements that you heard at the break. We're just greedy. We want all your money. I'm sorry. That's just how it is. Podcasts are not cheap. They take money to make, especially all the gin that I keep getting these guys.
Gin budget.
Yeah,
man.
It's pricey. And
it's good stuff.
Like, a bottle of chartreuse is $60. My God, that came out of my own pocket.
I shouldn't have drank the whole thing.
It was good, though. It was worth it.
It's very tasty.
Anyway, so yes, you can find that at patreon.com/retronauts. I do that every damn time. And for $3 a month, you can get early access 1 week ahead of everyone else for each episode. And also you get the episodes in higher bitrate quality. So it's a great deal. Anyway, we appreciate your support. Even if you just listen, just tell your friends how much you enjoyed listening to these old people talk about old video games and saying that it's okay for young people to like them too. Because that's what it's really all about, is sharing the love of video games. And we'll be back next week with more talk about old games. And again soon with a micro episode, and we'll keep doing more of these like loose personal recollection episodes because they're fun. So please look forward to that.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.